Okay, so this is lecture two in the excretory system. And if we take a look at the mammalian kidney, we look at it has two main functions. One is excretion. Can everyone say that for me? Excretion?
Excretion.
And one is water balance.
Water balance.
Guys are great. Now, one of the things I want to point out to you is that I want you to don't get confused, because some students, you know, they don't fully get the human body, and they get confused between two different things. We have a digestive system, which is where we take food, and we break that food down into smaller units, and then we're able to absorb that food through our small intestine. And then whatever's left, which is sort of we're unable to digest, that's what leaves our body. And that's kind of nasty because it has bacteria in it and it smells and it's just, you know, it's not good stuff. The excretory system is completely different. What the excretory system does is one of the things is to remove urea, which is simply a byproduct of nitrogenous waste that is being broken down, and also other things that are other molecules that need to be eliminated from the body. And it's sorted out in the kidney, and then what the kidney makes is this liquid called urine, and the urine then leaves. And what's interesting about this is I was going to do something that happened to my father when he was in, my dad was a doctor, when he was in medical school, told me this story that when his professor lectured the students on the excretory system, he had a beaker of urine up at the front of the classroom. And he stuck his finger in the urine and then licked his finger. And he just to show that urine isn't bad for you, there's no bacteria in it, it's perfectly fine. It's just kind of a derivation of blood. You know, it's filtered blood, essentially. Okay? And so what he did is he made every student come up and stick their finger in the urine, and then, yeah, and then they licked their fingers. Okay? And now, what's interesting is, no, it was real urine. But what? So all the medical students, all the medical students came up and did this. And then when they were all done, he said, "I'm glad you guys did this because, you know, urine is totally safe. But I want to point something out to you. You all are horrible observers." And then what he did is he reenacted what he did. He took his index finger, stuck it in the urine, pulled it out, and licked his middle finger. So he never licked the urine, but everybody else did. Now, I was going to do that this morning, but I thought that I might lose my job. So I'm just telling you the story, okay? So there you go. You can say, "Mr. Hammock is really actually a nice guy." Okay? So let's talk a little bit about the kidney. So the kidney, if you see in my picture here, there we have two of them. They're located sort of where your lower back is, kind of inside, you know, that area. And if you do a cross-section of the kidney, you'll notice that, and it's actually illustrated here on my picture, the outer part is called the renal cortex, and the inner part is called the renal medulla. Now, just a word derivation, you're going to see the word cortex several more times in this course, and I want you to understand what it means. Whenever you see the word cortex, it means outer. That's the meaning of cortex. I'll give you another example. You've probably heard of the cerebral cortex. It's your brain, right? Your brain, your cerebrum is the main part of your brain, and the outermost part of that is called the cerebral cortex. It's actually where most of your thinking occurs, your higher order thinking. So there's another example of the use of cortex. When we talk about plants, we talk about the cortex of the tree, and that's the outer layer of cells. And so the word cortex will pop up several other times in this course. So just realize cortex is not specific to the kidney. It's just referring to the outer part. Now, the word renal is referring to the kidney. So whenever you see the word renal, think kidney. Medulla means the inner part, or the think medulla, think middle. You know, right? M-M, it's easy to remember. And so, like in your brain, you have your medulla oblongata, and that's sort of in the middle of your brain. Once again, this same idea in terms of, it's more about location than function. So, and then finally, what is the, one of the things I want to tell you is I want to remind you, a theme that comes up in, you know, again and again in biology is that structure leads to function. So when we look at the kidney has a certain structure, as you're going to notice today. This structure is critical to its functioning. And the main functional unit of the kidney is called the nephron. Can everyone say that for me? Nephron? And the nephron is illustrated, if you take the second picture here, and you take a little slice out of the kidney, and you blow it up, which you see down here, you will notice there is this sort of yellow colored structure that looks like a big convoluted mass that then has this loop that goes down and then back up and then another convoluted mass of tube, and that whole thing is called the nephron. And so the nephron is really an important part of the kidney. It's really the functional unit. And if you look at the very, and then there's a blow up of the nephron here, and it turns out that the nephron is made of this sort of tight ball of capillaries, which then there is this long blind-ended tubule that I just mentioned that starts at that tight ball of capillaries and goes down and back up, and that whole thing is nephron. And so we'll sort of get into that in more detail in the next several slides. So what I want to sort of walk you through is the basic anatomy of the nephron. You notice that there is an arteriole that comes in, and then it breaks up into this ball of capillaries. And this ball of capillaries has a special name. It's called the glomerulus. Can you all say that for me? Very good. Now, the glomerulus, you know, obviously a capillary bed is where you can have movement of material across the capillary bed, and that's exactly what happens. And so surrounding this glomerulus is a blind tube. It's the beginning of the excretory system, and that blind tube is called Bowman's capsule. It's simply named after the guy who discovered it, Dr. Bowman. So let's say that, Bowman's capsule. And then it sort of forms this cup that sort of surrounds the glomerulus, and that's where you filter the blood. The blood filters through into the excretory system. And then you get a tubule, and there's three parts of this tubule. There's the what we call the proximal convoluted tubule. And let's break down that word. Convoluted simply means something that kind of is going every which way. You know, it's kind of this mat. You know, as you can see, there, it's all convoluted. The word proximal is from the Latin word proximus, which means nearest. So when you see that word proximal, you should think nearest. And the reason we call it proximal convoluted is because it's nearest the beginning of the excretory system. In other words, it's closest to Bowman's capsule. And then you get this loop of the tubule that goes down and then does a 180-degree turn, comes back up. That is called the loop of Henle, once again named after the guy who discovered it, Dr. Henle. And then up at the upper part again, you see it becomes a convoluted tubule. But now we call it the distal convoluted tubule because dis means apart or away from. It's a Latin word for that. And so it's farther away from the Bowman's capsule. So it's the distal convoluted tubule. And then what you now have is that will dump into this one more structure, which goes straight back down, called the collecting duct. And the collecting duct is technically not part of the nephron because you can actually see a bunch of nephrons actually will empty into a collecting duct. So it's not exactly the nephron. It's just where the nephrons all empty into. And then that And by the time the fluid gets to the collecting duct, it is now considered urine. And it will, as you'll see in the next picture, it will be dumped into what's called the renal pelvis. And so if you look at my picture here, you'll see you've got the renal cortex, the renal medulla, and then the renal pelvis, and that's where all the different collecting ducts dump their urine. And then the urine will leave the kidney through the ureter, which is the one tube that leaves out of the renal pelvis. Okay? Now, remember that the circulatory system, if you remember from, we talked about this last week, obviously the blood has to enter the kidney, and it does it through the renal artery. And then the artery breaks into smaller structures called arterioles, and it's the arterioles that we see entering the glomerulus. And then the arteriole, when it gets to the glomerulus, gets it even into smaller vessels, which are called capillaries. So remember, when we leave the heart, we go heart, and then we go into the arteries, then the arterioles, then the capillaries. And so you can see the whole flow here. Now, in the next slide, we see, like I mentioned, the blood enters the nephron via an arteriole, and then the arteriole becomes a network of capillaries, and this ball of capillaries, like I mentioned, is called the glomerulus. Let's just say it one more time, glomerulus. Good. And then what happens is small ions, solutes, urea, water, they're all forced under hydrostatic pressure out of the circulatory system and into the excretory system. And the things that don't leave are large plasma proteins, red blood cells, white blood cells. They can't move through this membrane. And so all this material is moved into Bowman's capsule. Bowman's capsule surrounds the glomerulus, and it's the beginning of the excretory system. So the transfer of material from the glomerulus, which is this ball of capillaries, into Bowman's capsule is movement of material from the circulatory system into the excretory system. Okay? And now the name of the material is no longer blood. It's now called filtrate. It's not called urine yet. We're going to be making urine as we go through the process today. Yeah.
It's kind of like a cup around.
Yes, it's a cup around it. And that just gives a nice area, surface area, for all this filtrate to move from the capillaries into the excretory system. You don't want to have just one point of contact. You want to have a large area that you can move this stuff across.
So it's just where it goes after it leaves the circulatory system.
Exactly.
That leads into the
Yes, exactly. It's a blind-ended tube. It's the end of, depending on how you look at it, it's the beginning of the excretory system.
It's kind of like a funnel.
It's like a cul-de-sac. You know, imagine a road, you follow a road, and you come to a cul-de-sac. Bowman's capsule is a cul-de-sac that shapes around the glomerulus. But unlike, if you think of a cul-de-sac, you drive into a cul-de-sac, but it's the opposite. In this case, things enter the cul-de-sac and then leave through there. And the cul-de-sac, which is really essentially Bowman's capsule, is the beginning of the excretory system. It's where the filtrate begins. Okay. So what happens is, as I mentioned, the filtrate is now in the glomerulus. But what's interesting is if you look at my picture here, those of you that are very perceptive will say, hey, the blood comes out of the glomerulus and now becomes an arteriole, but look, there are some more capillaries that are surrounding the convoluted tubules, both the proximal and the distal convoluted tubules. And we have a special name for these. These are called the peritubular capillaries. Once again, let's break the word down for you. Peri comes from the Greek word, peritubular. The peri part comes from the Greek word, which means around. And that's where we get our word perimeter, right? Which is, the perimeter of a property is the edge, of a property. So the peritubular capillaries surround the tubules, okay? And the solution that's in the Bowman's capsules is called the filtrate, but because the membrane doesn't, you know, the filtering is non-selective. In other words, lots of small molecules get into this filtrate, and some of these solutes are not waste products. You can have glucose, which is, you know, you don't want to lose glucose. You've got vitamins, and you need to get these back. And that's what the peritubular capillaries are for. They're there to recover some of this material. I call this the long and winding road, the filtrate's journey to becoming urine. And you can sort of imagine the Beatles, you know, sort of, if you know that song. And if anyone wants to write a song based upon the long and winding road, but have it all be about the excretory system, that would be wonderful. So, extra credit. I want to review with you what we talked about in our last lecture, which is sort of just a conceptual overview of the excretory system until I get into the nitty-gritty details. And it's really a four-step process. The first thing that happens, we just mentioned, is filtration, and that's simply moving material from the circulatory system to the excretory system, and that happens between the glomerulus and Bowman's capsule. Then you get reabsorption, and reabsorption is where you, both through active transport and passive transport, move some of the filtrate back into the blood, stuff you don't want to lose. Then you also have secretion, which is both active and passive transport from the blood back into the filtrate. This is stuff that should have gotten filtered out but never did, and you need to get it out of the body. And these would be like toxins or maybe excess salts. And then finally, at the very end of this process, you get what's called excretion, which is elimination of the waste filtrate, which is we now know as urine. So that's a four-step process. What I'm going to do now over the next several slides is we're going to really get into the details of exactly what's going on. And so here we go. Okay. Now, before I begin this whole process, let me say something. What I'm going to tell you over the next several slides can become very confusing. When I first learned this, it was a mind-bending experience, because I tried to actually logically follow everything. I think this is one place where at first you need to sort of suspend your judgment and just learn what happens and then go back and kind of logic it out. But if you try to go stepwise and think logically how each thing causes the next thing, it will become very, very confusing. So just a warning from me, just don't do what I did. Just accept what I'm going to give you over the next four or five slides. And then once you kind of memorize it and you're kind of going, this is what happens, then you can kind of think through what's really going on. I think it'll make it easier for you. And my goal is to make it as easy as possible to learn the process of how the kidney works. So we're going to start with the proximal convoluted tubule. And in my illustrations from now on, they won't be exactly the way it is in the body. It'll be more diagrammatic, but so we can show what's happening. So you see the proximal convoluted tubule, and the first thing that happens is called reabsorption. And in reabsorption, you have active transport of glucose, vitamins, nutrients, amino acids from the proximal convoluted tubule into the interstitial fluid and eventually into the peritubular capillaries. So really the movement is from the tubule to the interstitial fluid to the capillaries. And remember, we talked about this term interstitial fluid. It's the fluid that's not inside the circulatory system. It's not inside the lymph system. It's not inside the excretory system. It's kind of in the tissue between systems, essentially. And when we say active transport, what do we mean? Can someone tell me what I mean by active transport? Yeah. It takes energy in the form of what? ATP. So the kidney actually uses a lot of energy to do what it's going to do. So kind of be aware of that. The kidney is energy intensive. So you actively transport these things back into the body, essentially. And then you also actively transport sodium. And then chlorine passively will follow because chlorine is negative, sodium is positive. Opposites attract. If you can get sodium out, chlorine will just passively follow. And then water will follow the sodium and chlorine because, if you remember, you know the process of osmosis is simply water going down its concentration gradient. So if you move a lot of solutes out of the filtrate, then water is just going to naturally follow. And that's an important concept we're going to talk about in the next few slides. Finally, what's also going on up here, is secretion. And that's active transport of drugs and toxins that have been processed by the liver into the filtrate. Maybe they didn't get filtered at the glomerulus, but you still want to get them out of your body. So they have to be actively transported out of the circulatory system into this filtrate. So that's going on as well. Now it gets technical. So please hang with me here. I think it will, once again, sort of suspend your disbelief, learn it, and then you can come back and it'll make sense. So if you look at the loop of Henle, now, first of all, look at this cross-section of the kidney. The yellow part up at the top is what we call the renal cortex. Remember we talked about that? And as you go down, you're going into what's called the renal medulla. Okay, so just kind of get oriented. So the upper part is the outside of the kidney. And notice that the loop of Henle goes down, and then it does a U-turn and comes back up. This part that goes down is called the descending limb of the loop of Henle. The part that comes up is called the ascending limb, and they act totally differently, as you're going to see in the next few minutes. So, first of all, we need to define osmolarity. Osmolarity is real simple. It's the concentration of solutes in a solution. The more solutes you have, the higher the osmolarity. Okay? And if you notice on my picture, and it's probably hard for you to see in lecture, but when you're on the internet tonight, you should be able to see this. On my bottom picture, on the far right, I have the osmolarity of the interstitial fluid. And you'll notice, and I'll try to read it as best I can, it goes from, I think, 300-ish all the way down to maybe 1,000. So as you go down into the medulla, you get more and more concentrated, okay, outside of this whole filtrate loop of Henle and so forth. So what happens is, and this is really important to know, the descending limb of the loop of Henle, it's lined by epithelial cells. These epithelial cells are not permeable to sodium chloride. Sodium chloride cannot go through this tube. But it is permeable to water. So what happens is, as the filtrate moves down the descending limb of the loop of Henle, outside, it's more and more concentrated, right? More and more concentrated. So what that's going to do is that's going to draw water out, because water's going to want to go down its concentration gradient. So if you actually look in my illustration at the bottom here, you can see H2O is leaving the the loop, the descending loop. What's going to happen, therefore, inside the loop as you go down, down, down? What's going to happen? What's going to happen to the loop, the solution inside the loop? Yeah. It's going to get more and more concentrated. So its osmolarity is going to go up. And if you actually look at it, it does. You'll see in my lower illustration, it gets more and more concentrated till you get to the bottom, and it's got a concentration of about 1,200, pretty high. Now, what's interesting is that So that's what's essentially going on. Now let's take a look at the ascending limb in the next slide. Once again, I want you to suspend your disbelief and just memorize this. If you look at my picture, the ascending limb actually has two sections, a lower section and an upper section. The lower section is called the thin segment, and the upper section is called the thick segment. So you need, they're different. And what happens is, in the ascending limb, it turns out that the epithelial layer, this layer that lines it, is permeable to sodium chloride, but not water. Interesting. So on the way up, there is passive transport of sodium chloride out of the tubule. It's just going to go down its concentration gradient. That's just natural because it's more concentrated inside the tubule than outside, so salt's going to leave. When you get up to the thick segment, sodium chloride is actively transported out of the tubule. Now, water can't follow, and so what happens to the filtrate? It becomes what? It becomes more dilute, okay? Because water stays in, salt is leaving, it becomes more dilute. And you can actually see, if you look at my lower picture, you'll see that, yes, indeed, it becomes less and less concentrated, okay? Now, finally, we get to the collecting duct. Now, the nephron, remember, the collecting duct is not part of the nephron per se, because a number of nephrons will dump into their filtrate into the collecting duct. And that collecting duct, if you'll take a look at it, it actually goes back down into the medulla. It goes through the medulla of the kidney and eventually ends up in the renal pelvis. And what happens is, along the there's epithelial cells that line the collecting duct, and they are permeable to water, but not sodium chloride. And so you get passive transport of water out of the collecting duct, once again due to osmosis. And what's interesting, because of that, as this solution moves through the collecting duct down into the medulla, your water's going back into the body, and that means the filtrate, which now is becoming urine, is becoming more and more concentrated. And by the time it reaches the renal pelvis, you got a concentration of urine that's about 1,200 milliosmoles per liter. And that is, if you want to compare that, blood has a concentration of about 300. So it's much more concentrated than blood, which is what you want to do, right? You don't want to lose lots of water because you're a terrestrial organism, but you do want to get rid of all these ions and urea and stuff that you don't want. And so that's what the kidney does. And that's why you have all this crazy system of a loop of Henle going down and back up and then the collecting duct going back down. It's very cool. Now, how is this controlled ultimately? It's controlled ultimately by antidiuretic hormone. Can everyone say that for me? Antidiuretic hormone?
Antidiuretic hormone.
Okay. And what happens here is the word diuresis is the Greek word to pass urine. In other words, to pee. Okay? So antidiuretic means to prevent making urine. And so antidiuretic hormone is actually made up in the brain. And at the very base of the brain is a little, looks like a little punching bag. It's called the pituitary gland. And right above the pituitary gland is the hypothalamus. And there are cells that extend from the hypothalamus into the posterior pituitary, and they make this hormone. It's called antidiuretic hormone. And it's made in the hypothalamus. It goes through this, it's inside this cell, but the cell actually releases antidiuretic hormone into the blood system at the posterior, in the posterior pituitary. And then it goes through the body, and there are osmoreceptor cells up in the hypothalamus. They're constantly monitoring the blood. And remember, the blood is about 300 milliosmoles per liter. If that changes, then it will alert, particularly when the blood osmolarity rises above about 300 milliosmoles per liter, it will stimulate the release of antidiuretic hormone. And so what might do this? Well, if you sweat a lot or you have diarrhea, you're losing a lot of water, your blood osmolarity is going to go up, you're going to release ADH. What ADH does is it causes the epithelial lining cells lining the collecting ducts to become more permeable to water, so then you pull more water in. Very cool. So it's a neat system. And it's a homeostatic a regulating mechanism, and you should memorize this because this could appear on the College Board exam. They love these homeostatic regulating mechanisms. Now, it turns out that alcohol and coffee inhibit the release of ADH. Interesting. If then that, what happens is you don't bring back the water into your kidney through the collecting ducts, and so you pee it out. And so whenever you drink lots of coffee or lots of alcohol, you'll just make lot. You'll have dilute urine, and you'll pee a lot. And one of the things that it's thought is that a hangover may partially be due to dehydration. You simply, alcohol is acting as a diuretic. It's causing you to pass urine, and you're losing too much water. So what you should do is, if you drink too much, you should drink a heck of a lot of water before you go to bed, because that will prevent the dehydration and maybe some of the symptoms of the hangover. But so it's a really interesting system, and this illustration you see on my slide is worth memorizing for the test.